At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
68th Scroll, Chapter 1. And the apes went into the forbidden zone, abiding not by the law, but by vain curiosity for that which should remain unseen. And the prophecy of the wise ones was fulfilled, when a talking man fell from the skies to bring the end of days. Dr. Zaius. Oh, Dr. Zaius. Yes, that's right. With the Kingdom having just opened its gates in cinemas, we are back looking at 1960, its original Planet of the Apes. Hello, welcome. I am your regular host, Mike, here on Silver Screen Cinema Classics. And 68, still a classic film. Don't anybody come at me in the comments. So, to look at this ape-centric affair, I am joined by two other people, hopefully that are going to fare better than the two people on Taylor's Mission in the movie. First of all, my usual co-host, who is hoping not to be killed, stuffed, and placed as an exhibit, DK.
It's a madhouse!
It always is in here. You know that well enough, DK. Welcome. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thanks, mate. And being stuffed sounds quite good at this juncture.
Keep your kinks to yourself. We are joined by a first-time guest on the Silver Screen podcast, but you will have heard her on our sister podcast, Hit or Miss Star Trek, if you're a listener. So hoping not to die from an air leak or find herself inadvertently lobotomized, please welcome from Sci-Fi Queens podcast, Nita. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes, I know you're
talking about one of my favorite movies. I'm a big Planet of the Apes fan. I've seen every movie, so I was enjoying rewatching the original.
Nice. That's fantastic. And just a quick programming note, audience, if I sound a little bit off, we're having to record this episode a few days late because I've been suffering from a really rough cold that's been kicking my butt. So if I'm sounding a little croaky, that's why. Don't worry, I haven't been hunted down by a gorilla and had my throat slashed or anything. So that's the reason why I might be a little off. But I can talk. I promise I can talk.
Should we call you Bright Eyes?
Do you know what? Yeah, I've been called much worse. Let's go with it.
Nita, you do that. I'll just keep turning the hose on him.
Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty DK. So, before we jump into the actual film itself, as you'll know if you're a regular listener, or viewer, we sometimes like to start with a little bit of, getting to know you with our guests, a little bit of background information, and, you know, some questions about the film. I'll probably try and put a time code in if you want to jump straight to the review. But before we do that, like I said, Nita, this is your first time on Silver Screen and your first time on Cinema Classics. So we've been asking all of our first-time guests, do you actually have a favourite classic movie? And by that, our proviso is that it's got to have been basically from the birth of cinema to 1979. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, I love the Planet of the Apes series. But I do also love I don't know if this movie falls in that category, but I love the original Twilight Zone. Okay. Yeah, the ones in black and white. Those are really fantastic. But honestly, I think that my love for cinema movies really started with watching Planet of the Apes. My brother introduced me to all things sci-fi. So when that came up on the television, we watched it, and it was and they were having like the first and the second one, so we watched like the first and the second one. So I watched this maybe in the mid to late 70s. So the first two were out. You can't go more classic than Planet of the Apes.
That's fair enough. So your choice would be the film that we're looking at, conveniently.
Yeah, honestly, yeah.
Fair enough, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's cool. So this question is for all of us, basically, then. And again, it's a question we often ask on the silver screen, all different flavors, which is, what was your first experience of seeing this movie, and how did you kind of respond to it at first? And GK, I'll come to you since you sat out the last question there.
I can't really remember the first time I saw it. I just know that it was a regular in our house on TV. I'm not sure if they rented it from the video store, my parents, or if it was just on TV. And, a lot of good memories about this one. Specifically about the opening for a lot of it. But it kind of threw me this time because I didn't... It took so long for the apes to actually turn up on screen, and I can't remember it taking that long. So, yeah.
It doesn't feel like it, but it is 30 minutes until an ape shows up, yeah. Bizarre. Yeah. Cool. So what about you, Nita, then? What was your first experience? You've kind of already told us, I think. But
yeah, I just love the monkeys and the gorillas, and because I've always been a big animal fan, right? Love going to the zoos, because I don't think I understood the social message that it was giving.
Right.
And to be honest, at the end, I was like, why is the Statue of Liberty on the floor? My brother had to kind of explain that to me, what happened. It kind of had to be put together. Like, I was so enamored by the gorillas and the monkeys actually talking and walking upright and doing what they do that, the first 30 minutes was a little bit rough. I remember that because it was like, okay, what's happening? I think the movie really, really, truly begins when they get exposed to the gorillas and the apes.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. So this obviously is a film that launched a massive franchise, which is part of the reason why we're talking about it. As I said, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes has just opened in cinemas, the 10th cinematic film release, believe it or not. There's also two TV series, one animated, one live action, behind-the-scenes documentary, and several comic books, including a fantastic crossover with Star Trek known as the Primate Directive, which I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend if you haven't had a chance to check that one out. Do we have any experience with the franchise as a whole? And I'll tell you about my experience with the film as we dive into this as well. And what's your exposure to the overall franchise, and how do you feel about it? TK, I'll come to you again first, by now.
I'll own up. I've not seen the animated series. I've not seen the live action TV series. I'm just strictly a movie watcher, and this one was the only one that they showed during the daytime with any frequency on terrestrial TV. The others were shown pretty much late at night on BBC One, and the majority of it, 9 times out of 10, it was escaped from. I've seen those. I've seen the obviously the new trilogy. That's pretty much it as far as it goes. I do have the video game, the digital video game, but I've not actually played that yet, so I can't say what that's like.
Fair enough. And have you not read the Fantastic Star Trek crossover comic?
I haven't.
It's really weird because it tries to tie in the two things with the whole kind of like, you know, the two universes and the time travel and the fact that it's Earth all along, etc. And spoilers and stuff. So, yeah, it's kind of weird, but worth a look. Yeah. So what about you, Nita? What's your experience with the franchise? I would assume you're a fan of them all, probably.
Yes, well. I've seen every movie that has been released thus far, and do plan to see this new one coming out on the 10th.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen the television series, the live action television series. That was where I really got into it, because they really were able to tell you the story, right? Mm. And just love the storyline. Just enjoyed it so much. I've never seen the animated series or read the comic, which I am now, it's penciled in. I need to get this comic of Star Trek and Planet of the Apes, because those are my two favorite franchises, and to bring them together would be heavenly. So I'm definitely going to look for those comics to read.
Yeah, it's only a limited series. I think it's like 4 to 6 issues or something, so it's not hard to find, and it's not that much to read, but it's interesting enough, you know.
I think they did a really good job, because the live action series was back in the 70s, I think in 74. And they really did a good job with the limited amount of technology that they have now.
Mm. Oh, definitely. And we'll get into that when it comes to the sort of the prosthetics and things on this film a little bit later. Absolutely. As well. For sure. I'm surprised, actually, DK, that you haven't seen the live action series, because it was your guy, Roddy McDowell, who headlined it.
It was, yeah. But it's one of those things that I mean, you know, back when I was into it big style, I could never get hold of it.
Right.
It kind of passed me by.
No, fair enough. So, just to give you the background then with my experience with this film and the franchise, it's actually my mum who's a huge fan of the whole franchise. And I was telling DK off air, the first time I've kind of properly sat down and watched this movie officially was just a few days ago, which sounds terrible, but it's one of those that I have seen in passing when I was super duper young, because my mum would just have it on at random times. But being like too young to really understand what was going on, I don't think I really got it. So it was just kind of something that was there in passing, and you know how you kind of half pay attention. Mm-hmm. So I knew it was all right, and I liked it well enough and everything, and but I had never gotten around to actually like sitting and watching it and paying attention until just a few days ago. But it's like that with the whole kind of franchise of the first few, because my mom had this really awesome video set, like a box set of the first 5 Planet of the Apes movies.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, I don't think I've ever seen part of the second one, because she kind of thought it was a bit scary when I was younger. Because there's some apparently really... I've never seen it yet. I probably will watch it now, because they're all available on Disney Plus. So now I'm intrigued to go and watch them. But I never saw any of that. But I do recall fleeting glimpses of, like, Roddy McDowell and Ricardo Montalban on Earth, and a lot of, you know, the sequels where it's just a couple of apes and it's modern-day Earth and stuff.
That's Escape, yeah. I think.
There's a couple of them, I think, that have got Montalban in, because he... yeah, it all revolves around, like, their son, who is Caesar, and, yeah, it all gets very weird, basically. but I do remember my mum kind of sitting and telling me the lore of these things and trying to get me interested in, like, this, oh, it was the very first ape who was Caesar who said no to someone, and so I was the nerd who got super excited when that happened in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, I me too. I'm with you. I got so excited when that happened, because I knew the storyline.
Yeah.
But we hadn't seen it until that moment.
Exactly. So, yeah, I've obviously seen the most recent trilogy as well. Didn't really care for the others after Rise, to be perfectly honest, as much. Was an improvement. I just didn't really like Dawn. But I'm hyped to go and see Kingdom, especially knowing it's like 300 years after the others. So we're getting into very similar territory to the original now. So, yeah. Right then, before we dive properly into this madhouse... we're going to be popping over to DK, who's doing his usual behind the scenes and passing on a little bit of information about this film and giving my voice a little bit of a rest. So, DK, it's over to you. What do you have on Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, well, there is so much stuff for this. So I'm going to give a brief glimpse into it, and then I'll, you know, probably sprinkle a couple of things as we go. But yeah, I'll start off with this. It took 3.5 years of rejections from studios to get the film greenlit in the first place. Even Charlton Heston had doubts that it would ever get made. He said the novel was singularly uncinematic. All Arthur P. Jacobs had was the rights to the novel and a portfolio of paintings depicting possible scenes. There wasn't even a treatment outlining an effective script. Nevertheless, Heston stuck with the project throughout development, trudging studio to studio with his paintings and being laughed at. No kidding, talking monkeys and rocket ships, get out of here. Now, one of the biggest stumbling blocks preventing 20th Century Fox from committing to the project was its fear over how the ape faces would appear on screen. Eventually, they coughed up $5,000 for a test scene to be shot with Charlton Heston playing alongside the made-up Edward G. Robinson as Dr. Zaius and James Brolin as a character called, as Cornelius. The studio, they were excited about the results of this test, but still delayed greenlighting the film for a further 6 months. It was only after Fantastic Voyage in 1966 became a hit and showed the viability of science fiction as a genre that Planet of the Apes was given the go-ahead. But without Robinson, as he suffered from a weak heart and didn't think he could endure the day-to-day rigours of performing in the ape makeup. There is an asterisk here, which I will come back to later. The movie premiered on February 8, 1968 at the Capitol Theatre in New York City and then was released statewide on April 3rd by 20th Century Fox. It was a box office hit, earning a lifetime domestic gross of $33.3 million. It was one of the first films to have a major large-scale merchandising tie-in. Merchandise related to the film included toys and collectibles, action figures, picture storybooks, trading card sets, books, records, comics, and a series of graphic novels from Marvel Comics. It was the last big movie sci-fi hit prior to the release of Star Wars in the late 70s, and the merchandising of the film featured about 300 licensed items in total, including, toys, action figures, etc. It was the biggest merchandising effort of all time, up until, obviously, Star Wars, and was worth on its own about $100 million. So, yeah.
Wow. That's what you've got for us for now.
That's what I've got for now. As I say, I'll be sprinkling and definitely coming back to the Edward G. Robinson story.
Oh yeah, definitely. Fair enough. I'm intrigued because I don't know what that's about, because I did quite a bit of research on things that I did know, and that hasn't come up. So I'm interested to hear what that's about later.
That was really interesting. I mean, I'm sure that with all the struggles they had trying to get this first movie out, the last thing on their mind was this was going to be an epic saga with comic books and Star Trek and movies after movie and even a TV series.
Oh yeah, it took off in a big way for sure. Mm-hmm. Talking about like the rigors of the makeup and stuff, though, I don't know if you guys have seen that. Obviously, there's a lot of behind the scenes sort of footage in documentaries and stuff. And one of the more hilarious things about it is that because of the nature of the ape makeup, and the fact that, it's the 60s, so pretty much all the actors to a person were smokers. All of the images of them smoking have got, like, cigarette holders. So it's such a bizarre image. Like, there's tons of pictures of Kim Hunter, like, in ape makeup, looking like a Lady Penelope refined type of, like, a cigarette holder.
That is so true. That was
the only way they were allowed to, like, smoke and stuff. And
saw that documentary about the Planet of the Apes, and I thought it was hilarious. I'm like, really? You can't stop smoking just long enough for this movie?
No,
but as a non-smoker, I don't know how rough that would have been.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, filthy habit and everything, but it's an amusing image for sure.
Absolutely.
Supposedly things like I said, eating and drinking and stuff weren't the easiest either, but I'm sure you have a bit about that later on. So
I do, yeah.
So we're going to break into the actual review now then and talk about the various aspects of the film, as we always do, the writing, direction, etc. So we're going to start off with the writing, because why not? Do you have anything about the writing before I jump into my little notes, DK?
Yeah, prior to coming across the original novel, producer Arthur P. Jacobs, he was eager to remake King Kong. Now, while talking to a French film agent, he mentioned that this was his favourite film. The agent then outlined the story of Le Planète des Singes, about a French novelist who lands on a planet where apes are the superior species. This excited Jacobs, obviously. He bought the rights to Pierre Boulle's novel before it was even published. Now, Pierre himself, he was rather reluctant to allow any Hollywood studio to make an adaptation of his novel, as he reportedly thought the novel was his worst piece of work. The first director to spot the potential in the novel was Blake Edwards. He brought on board leading sci-fi writer and all-round legend Rod Serling. while Serling was able to come to grips with the structure, he gave full credit to Michael G. Wilson, not this one, for the final screenplay. Rod Serling.
It's just Michael Wilson, by the way. Michael G. Wilson is a different guy entirely.
Yeah. Rod Serling admitted he spent well over a year and 30 or 40 drafts trying to translate the novel to the screen. In his original script, the main character was named John Thomas. It may be an allusion to John Thomas. Stop it. To John Thomas Stokes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that and it caught me really off guard.
Yeah, yeah. Defendant in the famous Monkey Trial, dramatised in Inherit the Wind, 1960, which was in turn spoofed in the courtroom scene of this film. Ooh. The name, John, was retained in the Planet of the Apes Visionaries comic book in 2018.
Okay. So I have a little bit of information about the writing as well, if I may jump in, DK. I don't know if you had this on your notes, but at one point it was decided that Nova was pregnant, and scenes were actually filmed around the locations revealing Nova's pregnancy.
Oh, that would have been nice to see.
Well, you say that, but we'll get into why it was avoided. In the penultimate draft of the movie, Taylor was killed by the bullet of an ape sniper, and Nova, pregnant with Taylor's child, escaped and vanished into the Forbidden Zone. Although it was believed it was Heston who rejected the idea of Nova's pregnancy, those scenes were deleted, according to screenwriter Michael Wilson, again, not me, at the insistence of a high echelon Fox executive who found it distasteful. Why? He said, I suppose that if one defines the mute Nova as merely humanoid and not actually human, it would mean that Taylor had committed sodomy. Again, their words, not mine. It was also decided that Nova's pregnancy would detract from the film's ending. In any case, all of the scenes with Heston and Hunter in the sequence of Nova's pregnancy were cut, but he did say there's probably a great deal of footage of it somewhere.
I could see their concern, but at the same time, how... These humans that were there during this time had to reproduce at some point and somehow.
With each other, yeah.
Right. I mean, so I don't see how, you know, that would have been all that different to her. I think she would have known.
It's a very gray area, and I think it's not really made explicit in this film, but it is in the book and in future films that they're not like humans as we'd understand it. They've kind of devolved.
Exactly.
As part of the whole thing that's led to the apes, you know, intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be kind of like, you know.
It gives you more like caveman mentality.
Yeah.
Which is very instinctual. And I think that, yeah, if you want to avoid that kind of speculation or issues, you definitely want to avoid that pregnancy scene.
Yeah. Plus, I do kind of agree it probably would have detracted from the ending, which, you know, that impact and that shock can't be understated. And if you do add... on top of that, anything else, it kind of just feels a bit cheap, I guess.
Agreed.
So the other thing I have here is that the gag that I think we've alluded to, the see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil gag during the courtroom scene, which I love, was apparently entirely ad-libbed on the set on the day of shooting, and it was kept in because people found it amusing when the film was threatening to get too serious. So there you go. I agree.
Really,
I find that quite
I love it. I love that scene. Sometimes you gotta let the actors ad-lib, and sometimes it works.
Oh yeah, that was one of the things that really did work. And I agree, I think the film is getting serious, and that I don't think that sort of, you know, it doesn't come across as ridiculous or anything. It's just amusing. Just
exactly.
There's moments like that throughout the film, because at that point you've already had like human see, human do and stuff.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep. And the way they talk about humans, it's stuffing the humans and what they do to them. You know, the overall kind of theme of it fits.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it fits well. I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Especially when you realize, yeah. No, especially when you realize it is, you know, it's Earth basically just flipped on its, you know, upside down. But, which again, I suppose, I know there's been a lot of talk of this, and DK would probably just say, you know, Mystery Science Theater, get over it.
But, exactly.
Yes, it is worth pointing out that for the best and the brightest, Taylor and these astronauts never realized that the Earth's moon is quite clearly visible, or all the apes speak English. But
exactly, and if you notice, they all speak American English. That should have been like a key too, like where you landed. Like all across the universe is American English being spoken? I don't think so. I'm really happy with that.
We say they're the best and the brightest, but I mean, they're there with this kind of whatever cryo freezing equipment, and Taylor's just openly smoking a cigar in this, you know, top of
that first scene cracked me up. He's chilling with his feet up on the console, smoking a cigar while everyone is taking a deep nap.
Yeah. Really? It's so melodramatic as well, isn't it? When he's just like, and this is just a personal thing. I'm lonely. I miss people. And I'm just, where's this coming from?
It's like, did you not know you were going to be in stasis? Like, and how is it that a group of astronauts can look at a sky and not know where they're at?
It's been hundreds of years, to be fair, I suppose. But
I don't know. I think that they had to, by the second day, know they were on Earth.
They do try and disguise it by saying things like, oh, the dust cover is making it difficult to see the moon and the stars or anything.
They do try.
It's a throwaway line, and obviously you don't see any of it because it would cost money to have that effect. But I guess you kind of have to hand wave that kind of stuff away, don't you, really?
Exactly. That line is in lieu of having the effect of seeing that.
Exactly. Yeah, fair enough. So, yeah, and one of the things that I like about the movie, and it's a very random thing, but it's worth mentioning because it pervades the whole thing, is I love this idea that the kind of distinct species of ape are all different classes, as it were.
Yes.
So you have like the gorillas are the hunters, the orangutans are like the doctors and scientists, and the chimpanzees are just the working class, I guess, for want of a better word. So yeah, did you agree with that, Nita? Do you find that quite a clever conceit?
I think it was clever that they put them in categories, but it really, truly, if you learn about apes, you'll learn that it would make more sense for the chimpanzees to be the soldiers and the police officers and the guards, because chimpanzees are the most aggressive species of the apes. So much so that they have decimated gorillas. But gorillas are really peaceful, like calm. For you to get attacked by a gorilla, you really have to do something to intimidate and make that gorilla feel fear. Cool. Or you touch their babies, gorillas are not like a chimpanzee will attack you just because you're there. And they have been known, I've seen tons of documentaries. That's how I know all this stuff. I'm absolutely fascinated by ape life. the apes have been just completely, and they don't just kill the apes, they eat them. They're known to kill and eat each other. Technically, the more aggressive of the species would be the chimpanzee, which would make sense for them to be. But for theatrical reasons, I can see them using the gorilla because he's bigger.
I was going to say the gorilla looks like it's kind of bigger and more of a warrior look.
Yes, he does. So in that category, but gorillas are actually smarter than apes, than chimps. Yes. They learn a lot faster. So I think that for theatrical reasons, they did a good job in choosing it that way. But if you're going for accuracy, the chimps are the ones you need to be scared of.
Yeah, I think you have to remember as well how much of this was known in kind of 1968.
Exactly. Jane Goodall was still researching apes at the time. So we didn't have any of this information. So I could see that
as
definitely being part of it, is not having that information.
And as you say, the more recent ones kind of do get into a little bit of, the war between the different subspecies and things like that a bit more. So, yeah. Cool.
Oh, yeah. And you can see the orangutans are also extremely intelligent. And in the newer movies, you see that being depicted.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Awesome. So as I try and soothe my sore throat, that brings me to my next point, which was, I've never really sort of stopped and paid attention to the writing of this. But when I did for this podcast, I was kind of blown away at, like, the cleverness of giving Taylor the throat injury to kind of explain why they would think he was primitive and why he can't talk. Because, it would have given the game away much quicker, and it wouldn't have been as compelling if he could just immediately speak to them.
Absolutely.
And again, it just makes you wonder, I don't know if that's part of the original novel or if that's just something that they came up with for the film, but it's such a clever little conceit and gives you so much cool moments there, you know?
I absolutely agree. I love the fact that they gave him this throat injury, although they could have, I guess because of it was the 60s and, you know, special effects was what it was versus what it is now. I felt like his injury wasn't enough for him to lose his voice, but I think that it was a clever idea to give him this throat injury and that the doctor vets were fixing him up. Not really knowing they were returning his voice. Definitely I felt like him trying to communicate was really well done.
Yeah. And it also there's a nice ambiguity in the way that Nova kind of tries to hide the fact that he can write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it makes you wonder, like, is she doing that because she knows that if he displays more intelligence, it's going to lead to him being kind of, you know, castrated and experimented on and lobotomized?
Well, Nova has survived this world for how old, whatever age her is. She says she's in her mid-20s.
Yeah.
So let's say for almost 30 years, right? She knows how they think. She may not process thought the way you and I do, but her instincts are going to tell her what to avoid and what not to do. And quite frankly, can we really say that they hadn't been speaking humans before him? She had to have heard someone evolve to speaking or evolve to language and seen what they've done to them.
Yeah, well, exactly. Plus, I mean, yeah, she'll have seen what they did to people not even as advanced and know that, you know, don't take that risk or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basis. She's the true survivor of this movie.
Oh, yeah, completely. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, I should have said as well, as part of the kind of idea that Taylor can't talk at first, that's what gives you that really glorious moment, which I love, and it has so much more impact when he does finally speak. And his first words are just, "Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty," that iconic line. So when that moment came, again, I hadn't seen the movie like properly, but I know the lines and stuff from when it's been
absolutely
on. So when that line came up, I was like, yay!
You know? I love the face that the apes put on, like, excuse me, not only are you calling me, you're not supposed to, but you call me a dirty ape? Like, you subspecies? Like, they had this Karen, oh my god, I would never look
you at you didn't?
Yes! Exactly! Yeah. And I love I just love the themes that they incorporate. And those were themes that were relevant at the time. And again, science fiction always bringing real life situations to the cinema in a way that anyone who watches it can see it. And if you're really, truly paying attention, you'll catch up and see that.
Yeah, fair enough. And again, DK already mentioned this, but as I said, you don't actually see any ape until 30 minutes into the film. Did you notice that? And did you think it was an effective way of kind of keeping the audience waiting?
You know, the first time I saw it, I was young. So I felt like, oh, come on. Like, I didn't feel the movie really started until the apes came out. But as an adult rewatching it, I felt that that was actually smart. Give people the anticipation, because people who were watching this movie knew that there were apes at some point, but they didn't really know the dynamics of what was going to happen, the relationships, right? Of them not knowing that apes speak and they're astronauts and all of these wonderful things. So I think that the anticipation of them hiding in this field, in this grass, looking at apes on horsebacks just blew their mind.
Yeah. And I do think it has more impact because you've waited, and it didn't seem to me like half an hour at all.
I think it went pretty fast. It's one of those quick 30 minutes.
Yeah, for sure. Plus, it gives you a chance to get to know the characters, which, again, brings me to my next point. I think it makes it all the more horrifying when you see what happens to the other two guys that are with him, you know?
I mean, one gets a lobotomy, and the other one gets stuffed.
Horrible.
It's horrid. You know, my cousin and I was rewatching it together. I was watching it with her, and she was like, "Oh no, they have the one black guy. Okay, he survived. He survived the crash." And I'm like, and I've watched this movie. I'm like, "Oh, not for long, not for long." You know,
he still did really better than the one woman they had on the crew. To be fair,
for real, I mean, he did better than the woman. She didn't even make it. Like, yeah. How is that her? Equipment malfunction, no one else's does.
Yeah,
very weird.
And I know it's 1968, but I do have to say it's a really dodgy concept when they were like, we brought this woman because she was going to be the our Eve with our like hot on heavy help. I'm like, all three of you are just going to constantly impregnate this poor woman? What the
heck?
That's
what, man? I thought. That's the same thing that I came to remember. Like, who's gonna be the daddy? Because she's gonna be exhausted if she had to be having all your babies. Yeah. There's a limit to how many babies we can have before we get like, just done.
Aside from the kind of, you know, sexual politics and the kind of unfairness of it all, who, when planning this mission, was like, so we've got one woman, three men. Yeah, that'll do.
That works. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Surely one to one would make the most sense there, wouldn't it?
My question is, did she know that she was going to be the new E with these three guys? I mean,
I would hope so.
I hope so.
Maybe she found out and that's why the air thing happened. She was just like, screw this.
I'm going to pull the whole thing. Yes, exactly. You know, it's like, that's an area of the original movie that I would have liked that someone addressed.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah. They changed it as the movies progressed. They kind of changed the concept. They had to. That concept was atrocious.
Yeah, absolutely. you know, as is kind of the attitude towards Nova, because the way Taylor's just like an attractive woman, haha.
Exactly. And he's treating her like, first of all, like she understands all he's saying.
Yeah.
And like, oh, she's mine. I won't leave without her. And she's not your property. She survived this world a lot longer than you have. She doesn't need you. You need her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I don't think that would fly today, not least because, I mean, with.
Oh, not in the least.
With the best will in the world, Linda Harrison Nova gets nothing to do in this movie at all. She is really just, you know, ornamental. Mm-hmm. Which is annoying because, like you said, she's survived in this world for so long that you kind of think, surely she should be the one taking the lead and kind of helping to protect him at certain points, you know? But...
Because the thing is, had he done what she wanted, half that stuff that he went through and they all went through would have never happened because she survived this world a lot longer than you have. All those people have. And they just, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the key thing, I'm going to bring it up here, then we can move on from the writing. The key thing is, obviously, this is a not very subtle comment on science versus religion, which is one of the big questions that sci-fi, I think, can get away with that a lot of genres can't. So how do you think the film handled that? And did you kind of pick up on that at first, or was it a little while till you realized what it was trying to say? And what do you think it's trying to say? You know?
Well, when I saw it as an adult, I definitely picked up on it immediately. And, you know, you have these religious ape zealots doing exactly what the religious human zealots do, which is kind of sad. But this is what they do. And the same way they treat people is how they're treating it. And you're right. In sci-fi, you can address things of racial concepts, religious concepts, social concept, political concepts, and you can get away with it a lot easier putting out the information in an even way because they never... You had like people, you know, apes that were the believers, but weren't cruel. And then you had the apes that were non-believers who were nice and cruel. Like they had them in both sides, which I thought was really excellent. And I like the fact that they were able to combine some of the apes where, like Cornelius, I felt personally that he's like, yeah, I still believe in my upbringings and in my religion, but that doesn't mean I'm going to ignore the science.
Yes, 100%. And I think that's the thing.
Which
and
I also, like that.
One of the things it also does is display how religion can be co-opted and used by nefarious people and the way that it's kind of like used to obscure the truth, which is not the greatest, you know, and to kind of keep society down and keep certain people subjugated or whatever. Again, it's a comment that you wouldn't really get away with if it wasn't for the fact that most people would just go, oh, it's talking about apes. It's not relevant to us, which, as we know, it obviously is. That's what it's saying. Yeah, and I mean, that key line when he says to Cornelius, to Dr. Zaius, oh, yeah, you're the head science guy. You're also the keeper of the faith. And he's exactly. like, that's not a contradiction. And it's like, of course it's a contradiction. And, you know, you kind of can't be beholden to both as, you know, as rigidly as each other. So
exactly. I like the fact that he was trying to get him to see balance.
Yeah.
Because I don't see Cornelius' character as a character who is lacking the ape faith.
No, not at all.
I think he believed, but I think he also believed that science disproves some of the things that were being taught. He's not saying it's all wrong. It's just misleading to add to the story of their faith, their mythos, and I feel like he was trying to show, you know, we can have this balance. And I think he was right. You can't be, you know, the head of science and a, you know, religious leader and be the same person. I think that you can have religions and science working together, but you do need two separate leaders, someone who represents the interest of that one area. And I think that was really his point. It's like you're contradicting yourself by being one person representing both sides.
Yeah.
Because there's no balance in that.
Oh, completely. And like I said, I think it shows the way that, you know, religious zealots and particular sections of that area, you know, people organized religion and stuff can repress knowledge in a way that's not, you know, it's deciding it for everybody en masse that we don't need to know these things and the potential dangers of that, which, as I said, it's a very subversive thing for 1968.
Oh, absolutely, because especially here in the United States, you know, in the 60s and 68s, the movements were still happening. There was still an actual war being fought within Vietnam in 1968. There was still a lot of political issues. And I think that this movie addresses that. This is what happens when war happens. This is what happens when science takes over without supervision. And this is what happens when religion takes over without supervision. And needing that balance and needing that supervised authority to make sure that everybody is playing by the rules. Because I think that Cornelius was one that disapproved, and so did his wife. I forget her name. I know she's the main
Zira.
I know she's the main character, but I am a Cornelius lover. I think that they disapproved of the science experiments that were being done on the humans.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, and yet they're science people.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that, again, there's two other kind of sides of this big triangle of questions. And the first one is, faith versus science. The second one is the kind of idea that by showing apes doing to humans what we are currently doing to apes, it also gives a very interesting message about the way we treat animals and experiment on animals and things, which, again, they get away with because of that flipping of the rules, which would otherwise be considered probably woolly liberal thinking. It's only animals in the 60s, but it's surprising that it actually gets you to question that when you're like, it's horrific that they've lobotomized one guy and stuffed one guy. And it's like, well, we do that to apes. So
absolutely. And the scary part was that I was talking to my cousin. I was like, oh, we don't use actual dead animals. She goes, yeah, I think we do. And she looked it up, and the Museum of Natural History has actual statues of animals that once were alive. They taxidermied them. Yeah, and I'm like, ew, you just ruined my experience with the Museum of Natural History. But that's kind of sad. Like, let that animal die and rest in peace. Just because an animal doesn't express himself or herself with words, just because they don't think cognitively the way we think, does not mean that they don't have a instinct and a process to doing things, and that they don't know when danger is afoot.
Absolutely. And that's one thing that I've just literally thought of that I haven't really got in my notes, but to that point, I think that there's a bit of that in the way that the three subspecies of ape are kind of treated differently, and there's that segregation. And that could be a metaphor for kind of the way different people of different colors are treated and things. The gorillas are always expected that you're going to be the dumb, you know, hunter warrior types. Only the, like, chimps can be the, you know, doing the work, and only the orangutans can be the true intellectuals and the ones that lead and everything. So, it's weird because, like I said, by sticking to those roles, even though it's quite a clever idea, it does make you think, is there some kind of prejudice that's keeping everybody in these ways?
Well, and the interesting part of it that I like is that they took some of the behaviors of the apes, of the gorillas, of the chimpanzees, and they've included it as you see other movies in this genre of Planet of the Apes, you see the behavior being displayed and talked about little by little and that's because we've gotten to know more about these animals from that movie to the next movie to the next movie.
Yeah.
And that knowledge is being integrated in a way that it doesn't mess up with the canon of it all.
Are you back with us? Oh, DK, are you there? Or... he unmuted and then muted again, so I'm quite sure.
I think the doorbell man took him. It was really an ape, and now he's in a cage with a pretty girl, and he's going, I'm good.
Fair enough.
Sorry about that, managing? Guys.
And that's another thing. Why did she have to be so pretty? She's a wild child.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she would have been...
Everybody else was kind of ugly. If you saw the ugly other humans, they look like humans that you would imagine would be part of this world. She was exceptional. Yeah.
No, she's flawless skin, yes! Perfect teeth and everything. And you're just like, really? And she's supposed to be this
hairless
feral thing.
And beautiful. Her hair looked absolutely shiny and not tangled and messy. Like, yeah, no. I wake up looking worse than she does. How is that even possible?
Oh, bless. But no, I mean, to your point about the canon and stuff, I'm kind of hoping that this new film, and I know nothing about it, but I'm hoping it might get into a little bit of the lawgiver that's hinted at in this movie and explored in later ones, the way that they kind of pass down these laws to keep the, you know, the ape culture ignorant of the fact that they are Earth and that humans were once intelligent and stuff, and the way that was exploited into a religion. It's kind of fascinating to me, and it also plugs into the third point of the triangle of the writing that I was going to say, which was, there's a very strong, like, anti-war message that's there, yeah, which, again, for the 60s mm-hmm. is kind of shocking, you know?
Yeah, well, that was the movement that was going on in the 60s here in the United States was huge. I don't know about the UK, but in the 60s, there was a huge anti-war protest going on constantly throughout the U.S., especially in Washington, young people protesting and their rights being violated as peaceful protesters, and the police would agitate them, and when they would defend themselves, that's what they would show in the media. It's people actually just defending themselves from being, you know, hosed. They would literally take a hose and water, and you know how powerful a hose has to be to get rid of fire in a building. Hose will knock you out.
But yeah, I mean, even aside from that, the way that Taylor's entire character is just like, there's got to be something better than humanity is a very, a very stark comment on, like, we are crap as a people. And the big ending, which again, I don't want to, you know, get too much into just yet, but the very ending is basically just like, we finally just destroyed each other because we are just that dumb, really, you know.
Yes.
We couldn't come to any understanding, so we just blew everything up, which is...
Yeah, there was a big, brutal. Also in the 60s, big anti-nuclear weapon movement. And if you see stories about movies in the U.S. about people having bunkers, that was a real thing.
So, DK, you haven't spoken for a while.
He's in prison with the girl.
Yeah, my throat was damaged.
Do you have any thoughts on things that to do with the writing that we might not have touched on that you you know?
The final scene with Taylor coming across the Statue of Liberty was suggested by Serling. According to rumor, Pierre Boulle, he was greatly upset by the ending, but later warmed to it, eventually becoming to prefer the ending over the one he'd written. Have you guys gone into the novel?
No, I haven't, but I did have a note that the novel ends, ironically, much closer to the way the Tim Burton movie ends. It's nothing like the ending of the movie.
Yeah, the original novel, it also features a twist ending, slightly different from the film. Spacecraft crew does, in fact, land on another planet, some 350 light years from Earth. The main character, who is Ulysse, which is Taylor in the film, escapes from the ape authorities with Nova. They return to Earth only to find that it's undergone the same evolution, which, as you say, is, you know, very similar to that
Borrowings that we got from Tim Burton. The novel does add a further twist, however. Taylor's story has been told entirely in flashback after he and Nova fled Earth as well and left a message in a bottle floating through space to warn anyone else who might stumble across either planet. The bottle is then discovered by an old married couple named Jin and Phyllis, who are later revealed to be chimpanzees themselves, who dismiss the story, saying that no human could be intelligent enough to write it. As mentioned, Michael Wilson, again, not this one, was brought in to do a rewrite of Rod Serling's screenplay. Wilson's contribution is most evident in the kangaroo courtroom scene, Wilson being an embittered target of the McCarthy blacklisting witch hunts of the 1950s. In the original script, the female native humans were all bare-breasted. This idea was obviously nixed by Fox for the reasons of the censors. And the movie's line, "Get your stinging paws off me, you damn dirty ape," was voted as the number 66 movie quote in 2005 by the American Film Institute.
I think that's kind of, we thoroughly covered the writing, I think, between us there, mainly myself and Nita, so apologies, DK, but, you know, you did have to shoot off for a bit. Yeah. And, you know, deal with the apes. the only other thing that I had down, and it's kind of redundant, I know the way that the sequels deal with it, but I was very struck this time by how much of a harsh ending it is for Cornelius and Zira, because it looks like everything's, you know, oh, we're going to bring the truth to them, and then Dr. Zaius is just like, have them arrested for heresy. And it just ends that way, and I'm like, geez, that's brutal.
Yeah. You know?
When
you see this movie on its own, not, and if you don't know that there's going to be a sequel or a second movie, you kind of feel like they leave a lot of things unanswered.
Definitely. That's one of the things I mentioned in my conclusion as well. Yes, yeah. It seems
I think that maybe I'm hoping that they did this knowing there will be a second movie, because if they did this not knowing that there will be a second movie, then, oh my God, what were you thinking?
Yeah, exactly. I think back then in the 60s and 70s, they did film a lot of these things with that in mind. When you look at things like, obviously, you know, Dawn of Superman and the Three Musketeers movies. I think they kind of factored it in. I think 20th Century Fox looked at how much this one had cost and all this makeup that they'd done with this prosthetic and thought, we've got to get our money's worth out of this.
Definitely, definitely. Cool. Well, I'll move us to the next thing then. Again, we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but I was going to talk about the acting in this film. And first of all, just quickly, I've mentioned already Roddy McDowall as Cornelius is heavily associated with this franchise. He didn't play the same role, but he did star in four of the original five films. He was actually replaced in the sequel, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, but he was also in the TV series. And I know he's popular with you, DK. I've got to say, I thought he was fine. He didn't hugely stand out for me in this film, controversially.
I think it's just Roddy McDowall. It's just the fact that it's Roddy McDowall to me. I just love the dude. He can do no wrong in my eyes. With regards to McDowell, they spent, both him and Kim Hunter, spent a massive amount of time at zoos studying the apes, both at the San Diego Zoo and Kim Hunter at the Bronx Zoo. Although he's second billed, Roddy McDowell, he doesn't appear until 43 minutes into the film. And he came up with the idea and recommended it to his companions in makeup that they should frequently add like little ticks, blinks, assorted facial gestures to add a kind of sense of realism and keep the makeup from appearing mask-like. Mm-hmm. He reportedly became a merry prankster on set with the makeup, driving home with the makeup on and shocking some of the other drivers on the freeway.
I can see him do that.
Oh God, yeah.
I could absolutely see that.
Definitely. This will be interesting to you as well, Nita. He previously played Sam Conrad in the Twilight Zone episode "People Are Alike All Over."
Yes, which, he did.
Yep. Which, like the initial drafts of this one, was written by Serling. Conrad is an astronaut who crashes on Mars and is taken in by some human-like aliens to what appears to be a resort, but it's really a zoo for humans. So, very good episode, that one as well.
It was a very good episode, and he was amazing in it.
Definitely.
Nice. Awesome. Cool. Did you have any thoughts on Roddy McDowall's role in this film then, Nita?
I absolutely thought he did a genius work in this film. He was amazing. he really got the movements, and you know, because apes don't stand up straight, you know. And I think he got all of the movement, the body, stature, and all of the things correct, the facial expressions. I thought he brought a balance to the storyline, because, you know, his fiance at the time, she's all science, you know, and then you had the apes that were all religion, and then you had the humans, you know, Tyler Bright Eyes, who was all about how did these apes get this way, mentality, and how, you know, we were here first, train of thinking. But it was like he brought this balance. Okay, like he brought he was the mediator, I saw him as, between them.
Yeah, I think that was part of the issue I had. I think I found him just a little bit too soft on things, and I was more drawn to Zira, to Kim Hunter's performance as out of those two, as the kind of more vocal and the more kind of human sympathizing, I suppose. Would you agree? Did you like the way Kim Hunter was portrayed in the film, DK?
I think she was very well. She did very well. Watching it this time, as much as I love Roddy, I did a tremendous affection for Kim in this one. I think she gave a really good performance. And, you know, ironically, the most human out of all the characters. And you're even including the actual human characters in this one.
Yeah.
She's incredibly personable.
Yeah, she definitely is. Very forward-thinking, very much in charge. I think she represented the women that the women of the 60s was trying to achieve. The independent, strong woman who can do it all. And I think that she brought that into the character quite well.
I've got to say, at one of the test screenings, a woman walked up to Charlton Heston and asked how he was doing, and he had absolutely no clue who she was until she realised that she was Kim Hunter, because he just didn't recognise her without the makeup.
I love that you just coined the word "revealised."
Did I? Cool.
She revealised.
It's been one of those days, dude.
Yeah, but no, I heard that. Sorry, it's fun. Yeah, but they do look completely different with the makeup. It's effective work.
Yeah, she apparently found it so claustrophobic that she had to take a Valium each morning while being made up.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah. After a while, she didn't think she needed the pills anymore, and she went on set without taking one. After the morning's session, she thought she did fine, but her makeup artist then threatened to find someone to replace him if she didn't start taking them again, as apparently he'd become exhausted from wrestling with her the whole time that he was trying to apply the makeup. She reached a point where she would stop eating during the workday so as to not mess up the makeup. On the set, it became a regular event for the actors in their makeup to be given a banana as part of their lunch. And she grew incredibly tired of this prank, which became the source of an in-joke in... it's been a while since I've seen it, but apparently became an in-joke in Escape from the Planet of the Apes. She ended up requesting that she be scheduled in makeup for no more than 4 hours in a row, because by the end of several days, the glue used in the application, it had started burning her skin. And she ended up sleeping with Vaseline on her face to avoid having a bright red rash each morning. So she went through some stuff.
Yeah, it's rough. On the subject of that, though, the makeups and the kind of things, in a kind of weird kind of, Zimbardo psychologist proof type of way, apparently the actors that played the different subspecies of apes, the gorillas, chimps and orangutans, all sat for lunch in their individual groups. There was no reason. They weren't told to do that. They just did.
They just did it naturally. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really odd. Really odd.
That definitely would have been a great thing to observe. If you know, for a psychiatrist, and see that behavior, or even Jane Goodall.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, we should probably talk about the star of this film. So I'm going to try and, put my personal feelings aside, because I've got to be honest, I can't stand Charlton Heston personally.
He's Moses.
Ever since he responded to a school shooting with, come and take the gun from my cold dead hands,
Oh yeah, that was not. Yeah, yeah.
just no.
Mm-mm. Yeah, that was not. That's not very Moses-like of him.
Yeah, I can't stand him. He's one of those gun nut right wing types.
Yeah,
was.
Exactly. No. And
without wanting to speak too ill of the dead, you know, politics aside. Yeah, I mean, it's weird because Taylor's not necessarily a very likable character.
He isn't.
He is just kind of a jerk to the co-workers that he's with on the ship, and then spends all his time bitching about how humanity's crap. And you just kind of think, like, you feel like saying, maybe the problem was you.
It's, you look at it and you just think, who the hell picked this dude as an astronaut? Because he's just, yeah, he's not a very nice person.
And he doesn't know much. You remember the conversations that the other two guys were having with him? He didn't seem to have any answers. And he didn't want to admit that he didn't have any answers. Arrogant.
For a mission leader as well, he's just got no clue when it comes to the psychological health of your troops, because he's just basically like, get over yourself, you coward.
Exactly. He's smoking his cigar.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. He just sees the guy planting the little flag, and he just laughs his ass off at him.
Exactly. That's what you do when you go to another planet. Hello?
And, you know, the way the callous way that he talked about the crew member that he just lost, you just think, what
There's
kind
no
of
point in having
process?
A wake who's been dead for over a year.
Yeah. Yeah, what kind of screening process does Ansa have?
Exactly.
Not very good, apparently.
And the other guys were looking at him like there's something wrong with him.
Yeah, he's very much the, you know, John Wayne, you're the leader because you're the cigar-chomping hero and not because you've got any real skill type guy, you know. But,
yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I do kind of relate to is there has to be something better than my idea, but I maybe would have phrased it in a way that came across less like I'm just a misanthropist who hates all people. And
I'll be honest, when I'm watching it, I thought, I hate this guy. And then after a while, I thought, oh, fudge, this guy's me.
No! I don't want to know that.
You'd be less gun-happy, let's be perfect.
Yeah, I would try not to be a prick about it. I like my peace and quiet.
Yeah, there's a difference there for sure. Yeah.
Originally they were talking about offering the role to Burt Lancaster.
Oh, really?
Really?
I guess.
Yeah. And Marlon Brando was considered a backup, and Rod Taylor was considered by Fox themselves, and he was Rod Serling's favourite choice. But ultimately, they went with the much more bankable Heston, which is weird. Yeah. It's one of several projects where Heston took a role originally offered to Lancaster.
Yeah. I know my mum's a huge fan of his, and he was definitely the kind of, you know, the star of his day and everything, and that's why he was cast for the big name. But I just don't like the character or the actor. I can't really say much else other than that, you know. He gets a few great lines, don't get me wrong, and there's some good moments in there, but yeah, it's just, it doesn't fully work for me, that guy.
Yeah. Apparently he was ill quite a lot as well during much of the film. Apparently he got flu, which is, you know, rather apt considering Mike. but rather than wait for him to get better, the producers felt that his voice added something to the character. And after filming the scene where Taylor and Nova forcibly separated, he wrote that he was feeling like hell while shooting because of his illness, and felt even worse because every time they threw that damn fire hose at me.
Suck it up.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can live.
Out of my cold dead hand. No, the water. It's too hot.
And the water from a fire hose is really cold, by the way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the only other person to really talk about then is Maurice Evans playing a good old Dr. Zeus, the break dancing hero of Troy McClure's Planet of the Apes music. I think he's very good in the performance because I hate the character, and that's the point. He's the worst kind of zealot, so you kind of have to give him props for that because that's the idea. Would you guys say the same thing about him?
Yeah, he's one of those characters that you do love to hate. And he does it without kind of chewing the scenery, as it were. Even in that makeup, he takes it deadly serious at all times. And you just come away just loathing the guy. Especially after, you know, that, as you mentioned earlier, the turnabout with Cornelius and Zira at the end.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, I'll move us along then, because we're running a little short on time. So the next section would be...
I just have to say one thing with regards to earlier. The Edward G. Robinson was supposed to play Zaius. But yes, apparently the makeup was too hard for him, so he renounced and Maurice Evans got the role. However, in actual fact, it's allegedly because Edward G. Robinson just could not be asked to shave his beard off, making it impossible to apply the prosthetics. So apparently he was paid off by Fox and replaced by Maurice Evans at a cheaper rate, which saved the money in the long run.
He should have been told that, you know, only kids will wear beards. And then, which is such a bizarre line that comes out of nowhere. And it's like, that's not even true. But anyway.
Agreed.
So, yeah, the next thing we were going to jump to was the direction. And again, I'll throw to you, DK. Do you have any little snippets to begin with us?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, directors J. Lee Thompson and Blake Edwards were approached to direct the film, but Arthur P. Jacobs, the producer, upon the recommendation of Heston, chose Franklin J. Schaffner to direct the film. Schaffner's changes included an ape society, which was less advanced and therefore less expensive to depict than that of the original novel. He deliberately used odd skewed angles and handheld cameras to create a disorienting effect, much like what Heston's character experiences in the new world that he finds him in. There were three other endings suggested for the climax, but the one favoured by Heston ultimately won out. When Taylor says to hell with the scarecrows, they got into an argument because the studio wanted to cut the word hell to make the scene more family friendly because, you know, obviously.
I have another bit of information when it comes to the end of the film regarding that as well.
Oh.
In terms of like the language, yeah, they were very skittish about using that word. And so at the end of the movie, when Taylor basically says, "Oh, God damn you all to hell," they had to successfully argue with the studio that they weren't using the Lord's name in vain. Taylor was actually appealing to God to damn the people that had done this to the world.
Yeah.
So, I was like, wow, that's okay. Fair enough. Then. Yeah.
That goes to show you how much back then religion played a part in what was happening, what was being shown, what people could and could not listen to.
I mean, in terms of the direction, there's not really a lot that I have to say, just that I did think the first half hour was very cheesy B-movie sci-fi direction. There's an awful lot of, like, screeching and crash zooms and things, which, again, I'd never noticed, you know, when I hadn't fully watched the film and paid attention, but is it just me that picked up on that at the start of the movie? I was like, this is very...
No, definitely I noticed it, and the lack of real dialogue as well. The first 30 minutes is rough. You got to get past those 30 minutes before you can really decide if you're going to enjoy this film.
Because it's weird that the rest of the film doesn't come across as quite the sort of cheesy B-movie level. And I think even the Jerry Goldsmith score for the first half hour is very like, is this like pre-Forbidden Planet level of stuff or what? You know?
It does feel very basic. And it's not helped by the fact that the main character isn't likable. So you're supposed to root for these three astronauts. Two of the astronauts barely get a word in, and when they do, they're talked down by basically an asshole.
The other two astronauts were more likable.
Yeah, you're not quite sure who you're supposed to be rooting for in this because with science fiction, especially science fiction morality tale, you figure that sooner or later, the asshole's going to get his comeuppance, and normally that means, you know, buying the farm. And obviously it doesn't happen. Until later in the movie anyway.
But even in terms of like decisions that the director makes in that first half hour, you've already mentioned like it's so weird and jarring the way that they film Taylor laughing at the dude planting the flag.
Yeah.
It's given so much focus and emphasis and it's done so over the top and it's just like, what are we doing? You know, it's so weird. But I will say, I mean, the film settles after that first half hour and becomes something completely different. It's just really weird to me that it very much, you know, the direction and the tone, it's like they were going for a completely different tone to kind of, I don't know if it was just to reassure because there hadn't been any apes yet of like, this is a sci-fi movie, guys, don't worry, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, maybe that was just me speculating.
No, because as you say, when it gets to the apes, it's not just the fact that they're in makeup. It's the fact that you actually get the first likeable characters in the movie, which is, you know, Zira and Cornelius. And then you actually get a villain that's even more of an asshole than Heston. So his is kind of like turned down a little. And
yeah,
you come into much more familiar territory, as it were.
Yeah, for sure. But I will say, like, the film as a whole, I've got to commend the cinematography and the atmosphere. And even in that first half hour, the way that they use the natural light is just gorgeous. It looks very sort of beautifully cinematic, and it really works for me. And, you know, just little things like when the apes are first revealed hunting people, it's a really good first reveal, and it's played just the right kind of subtle, I think. It doesn't do that crash zoomy thing that I was dreading it would.
Yeah.
You know, it lets you see the gorilla on horseback and then cuts back as if it's like, what am I seeing? As opposed to just doing the dun-dun-dun thing. That's all of my thoughts on the direction. Was there anything that you guys wanted to bring up?
You've pretty much covered everything that,
yeah,
that I had, yeah.
Cool. Well, I have two notes really on the FX and the production design. First of all, obviously this film is groundbreaking. We can't emphasize that enough for its prosthetic makeup techniques by the artist John Chambers. And that won him an honorary Academy Award, which was presented to him by Walter Matthau and a chimpanzee in a tuxedo. It was based on techniques that were developed during World War II for disfigured veterans, apparently, which is fascinating.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And yeah. Other than that, the only other note I have on the production is it was a really cool weather effect. Start to where we saw the kind of lightning and stuff. I was like, oh, that was cool. Any thoughts on the VFX production design, things like that, you guys?
I think the effects were, you know, good for the time. It was 1968. There was limited. Now we have, you know, so much technology to make things look so incredibly real, make a scene go nighttime and they're filming during the day. Like, there's tons of stuff that can be done. They didn't have all of that. And I think they did a good job. And I think the actors getting all that makeup done really put up with a lot, and kudos for them. They all should have gotten awards just for putting up with that.
Yeah. just to emphasize again, like I said, I never feel at any point like I'm watching actors in makeup or in suits or in prosthetics in these movies.
Oh, absolutely.
1968, it's
really
breathtaking,
real.
How good. Very real. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I prefer it and think it has more character than the kind of recent CGI ones.
Yeah,
I don't know
definitely.
Why. I think, yeah, just it looks more real.
I think it's that kind of uncanny valley vibe in which your mind is automatically much more ready to accept practical effects. That's how I see it anyway.
Maybe, yeah.
It's weird, actually. The production, I mean, for the amount, and it was an amount, because when adjusted for inflation, it holds a world record for the highest makeup budget, which it represented about 17% of the total budget.
As you say, that's why they made 5 films and a TV show.
Well, exactly, yeah. They were trying to milk it, because the production was repeatedly trying to find ways to cut costs, particularly in the with the makeup process. One option was to put the actors in makeup and then transport them to the set. However, they couldn't drive in cars, apart from Roddy McDowall, who didn't, you know, gave zero. But they couldn't drive in cars for fear people would be shocked seeing a chimp driving on the freeway. So they had to spend quite a bit of the budget hiring helicopters in order to transport them from the makeup stage to the locations and filming. But one of the things that producer Arthur P. Jacobs did, he enlisted several journalists to play apes in the background, which was his clever way of ensuring that A, they would write about the film, and B, write about the film in a positive light.
Yeah, clever stuff.
That's
cool. That's
amazing information. I love that.
Yeah. And one last thing. I don't know if either of you guys picked up the Apes Village. It's modelled on the work of legendary Spanish architect Antoni Gaudí. And so, yeah.
No, I didn't. I always thought it was obviously to save money that, you know, there's no real reason why they're virtually, you know, pre-industrial, the apes, except it's cheaper. So,
yeah,
I never understood why they lived in huts, had all that technology and stuff.
Yeah, it's very incongruous when you see whereabouts they live and all that kind of thing. And, you know, someone stood there with a camera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, But not just that, they kind of explain, oh, the humans could never be this advanced as to make these things when they discover them, and even we can't do that. And it's like, yeah, why can you not do that? But yeah, never mind. So anyway, if I can clear my throat a little, I'll find I can talk. I can talk. I can sing. Oh, so that will bring us to the music/sound section, quite conveniently. And DK, I think you have pretty much the only note I have for this.
Yeah, Jerry Goldsmith received an Oscar nomination. The score is known for his avant-garde compositional techniques, as well as the use of unusual percussion instruments and extended performative techniques, as well as his 12-tone music, the violin part using all 12 chromatic notes to give an eerie, unsettled feel to the planet, mirroring the sense of placelessness. And allegedly, Jerry Goldsmith wore a gorilla mask while writing and conducting the score to better get in touch with the movie. So, yeah. Apparently some of the discordant musical sounds he created by using stainless steel kitchen mixing bowls. And, finally during the crash sequence, two very recognisable sound effects are heard. The first is the rocket-like sound of the Batmobile starting up from the TV series Batman, the Adam West version. And the second is the roaring whine of the engines of the Jupiter 2 from the original Lost in Space TV series.
Yes, sci-fi. You've got to love it.
Yeah, awesome. Exactly.
As I say, I'm aware we're pressed for time, so I'm going to carry on to the next section here. And just let you know that I hate every ape I see, from chimpan A to chimpanzee. You'll never make a monkey out of me. So anyway, in any case, that's going to bring us to the critics' response. And DK, you start us off. I think you've got the first half there. I should clarify before we do this, by the way, this being a Cinema Classics episode, we do critics' response rather than audience response, because it's generally assumed that the film will have a largely positive, you know, response, and that would be the response we would get from the audience. But it's just a way of doing things differently here on Cinema Classics. So yeah, TK, do you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, obviously the movie was met with critical acclaim, and it's widely regarded as a classic. It was rated one of the best films of 1968, applauded for its imagination and its commentary on a possible world turned upside down. Pauline Kael called it one of the most entertaining science fiction fantasies ever to come out of Hollywood. Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times gave the film 3 out of 4 and called it much better than I expected it to be. It's quickly paced, completely entertaining, and its philosophical pretensions don't get in the way. Renata Adler of the New York Times wrote, "It is no good at all, but fun at moments to watch." Oof, hot take there. Arthur D. Murphy of Variety called it an amazing film. He thought the script at times digresses into low comedy, but the totality of the film works very well. While Kevin Thomas of the Los Angeles Times wrote, "A triumph of artistry and imagination. It is at once a timely parable and a grand adventure on an epic scale." And finally, Richard L. Cole of the Washington Post called it an amusing and unusually engrossing picture.
Yeah, and I'll carry us on with the, just bring us home with that then, and say, as of November 2022, the film has an 87% rating on the review aggregate website Rotten Tomatoes, based on 60 reviews with an average rating of 7.60 out of 10. The website's critical consensus reads, "Planet of the Apes raises thought-provoking questions about our culture without letting social commentary get in the way of drama and action." On Metacritic, the film has an average score of 79 out of 100 based on 14 reviews. In 2008, the film was selected by Empire Magazine as one of the 500 greatest movies of all time. It was nominated for Best Costume Design and Best Original Score at the 41st Academy Awards. And in 2001, Planet of the Apes was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Took a while, 2001. I got to say, I would have expected it before then, but there we go. So, yeah. So with that all out of the way then, all that's really left to do is for us to give our thoughts, our favourite things and conclusions. So we begin with our favourite character, moment and line in the movie. So I'm going to come to you first, Anita, why not, and ask who's your favourite character in this and why?
It's Cornelius. I think that he just brings such a great balance to what was happening between science and religion in the culture of the apes. I love when he points out to the orangutan, you know, you're the leader of the religious leader, the spiritual leader, and the science, that is a contradiction. You know, he's letting him know we need that separation between the two. I love it. I love his character.
Fair enough. And what about you, GK?
It's surprise, surprise. It's also Cornelius. I love that he plays kind of like, you know, yes, he's a partner, but he's also a foil to Zira in the fact that he doesn't immediately buy into the whole thing with Taylor, but they win him round. And he gets up to bat. He puts his, you know, his own prejudices to one side, and he gets up to bat, especially in that courtroom scene. And, you know, even discounting that, I think some of the acting, some of the performance that Roddy McDowall puts into this is just fantastic. He can say so much with just a look, as you can see in my avatar, and I just love it. And I think he's, you know, he's good at the dramatic stuff, but sometimes he can make you just laugh just with a look, and I love that.
Fair enough. Okay. As I said earlier, basically, you'll be not surprised to learn that my favourite character was Zira over Cornelius. For her questioning nature, the way she stands against autocratic tyranny, and her compassion. I think I just slightly preferred her. So, yeah. So, what is your favourite moment in the movie, Nita?
My favourite moment in the movie is at the end, when he sees the Statue of Liberty and he starts screaming. We did it. We actually did it. He realized then what had happened to his world and that he was home. He was never in a distant planet.
Awesome. And what about you, GK?
Mine's also towards the end. It's not that scene, though. I'm going to go with the cave, the dig site, the whole exchange between Taylor and Zaius, where, you know, they hand him the doll. And, it, you know, would an ape create a doll that can talk like a human? I love that.
I also went exactly with that ending, Nita, because I think it might seem kind of dated and cliche and everything now, but you just can't understate the impact of it. And I think it's there's a reason why it's become the defining image of the franchise, basically. So, yeah, I went with that as well. And do you have a favorite line you could name from the movie, Nita?
The favorite line? You know, I think that... there's so many good lines there. But I do love when he says, keep your dirty hands off me, you dirty ape. You know, that whole scenario in the beginning when he finally gets his voice back. I think that's so excellent because that's when everyone now sees something's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, for the impact. Absolutely. What about you, DK?
Not the way that it's delivered, but I love the line. I'm a seeker too, but my dreams aren't like yours. I can't help thinking that somewhere in the universe there has to be something better than man. Has to be. And from my very, very sporadic experiences on social media, I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, well, and to quote a different movie, never will you find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy than the internet. And on a similar note, my quote is actually by Dr. Zaius, and it is, "You are right, I have always known about man. From the evidence, I believe his wisdom must walk hand in hand with his idiocy. His emotions must rule his brain. He must be a warlike creature who gives battle to everything around him, even himself." Yeah, that hits home a bit, unfortunately, so that's why I went with that. So, yeah, to finish us off then, we're going to give our usual conclusion and score out of 5 stars. And let's see. Should we start with you, Nita? Why not?
You know I'm going to give it a 5.
Okay.
I mean, there is no other. I mean, this is the beginning. No matter how horrible they represented women in this movie, it is the beginning of many movies that are going to get better and better as it goes along. I think there was a lot to be said about this movie that was positive. And very little that can be said that's negative, even considering the time that it was done in. So I'm gonna give it a 5-star.
Fair enough. Cool. DK, shall we come to you next?
Yeah, it's pure late 20th century pre-Star Wars sci-fi. Genre movies of that decade leave an indelible mark on you. Dark visuals are disguised for the often hard-hitting messages contained within. And Heston's movies at that time were chief among them. And this is notably chief among Heston's movies. And for good reason. Here we've got a science fiction story delivered in true Rod Serling style. A morality tale wrapped in a fantastic adventure. But it's a little more talking than I remember, and the odd line hasn't aged well. That, ooh, that she was to be the new Eve, get out of town. It's still a great watch, dealing with themes that continue to be relevant. I loved this as a child, and I still do, though it saddens me to see that the lessons from back when this was released still haven't been learned. The fantastic makeup and performances are the icing on the cake, and I've given it 4.5 out of 5.
Ooh, okay, interesting. Mine's a little bit long because I tend to like to get all of my thoughts out. So I just said it's probably difficult to understand for younger generations, but before there was Star Wars or the MCU, etc., there was Planet of the Apes. It was a franchise which dominated the world in the late 60s and early 70s, with a film every year from 1970 to 73, then a TV series. I can see why. The ideas put forward here are deeply compelling, and even this first movie with its brilliant world building seems to barely scratch the surface. I probably sound like a broken record, but like all good science fiction, it uses the genre to comment on deep issues reflected from our own world. Here we have the pivotal science versus religion debate, a commentary on animal cruelty, and even a powerful anti-war message. This must have been pretty radical for 1968. Additionally, as we've made clear, you cannot overstate the legendary brilliance of the prosthetics here. I truly never question that these apes are real and they never come across as actors in costumes. The story moves at a brisk enough pace, holds the interest, and has the mother of all payoffs. But I have criticisms as well. For a protagonist, Taylor is way too unlikable. Nova is literally set decoration who gets no agency and, frankly, nothing to do. The ending is shockingly harsh, but it feels like a cliffhanger in a way, leaving me desperate to know more, hence the many sequels and prequels. There's a bit too much of a hokey B-movie vibe at the very start and a couple of necessary logical leaps that are just a little bit too far for my suspension of disbelief to extend. But this is undoubtedly a brilliant movie that launched a franchise which blew up and took over the world. Yes, they did it, those maniacs. And I gave it 4 out of 5, which, putting those scores together gives us an average and a final score for Planet of the Apes of 4.5 out of 5. Exactly. Excellent. What you gave it, TK. So, yeah. So it turns out, oh my God, I was wrong. It was Earth all along. So you finally made a monkey out of me. And all that remains for us to do is to say thank you for joining us and putting up with my various bits of Simpsons quoting along with the discussion. You've got to quote the Simpsons when you can, when it's those classic years. But I think we've had a great discussion, and hopefully you've taken something from it if you're listening as well. And if you have any thoughts that you want to share with us on Planet of the Apes or anything else, or if you want to be a guest on the show, feel free to hit us up on our social media. There will be a banner on screen showing you all the places you can find us. But you can usually just type Silver Screen Podcast into whatever social media of choice you want to and find us. And there is a link tree in the episode description. That'll usually be where you can find myself. And if he's around, DK, we'll be frequenting our Facebook group and stuff, but not many other places. Is that right, DK?
Yeah, that's I don't go into the Forbidden Zone.
And I do not blame you. So, but I do know, obviously, Nita, you've been a guest before, and I know you have your own podcast. So did you want to plug where the people can find you and that?
Yes, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok, and YouTube as Sci-Fi Queens. And we're on every other Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Our next show will be on May 10th, and we're going to be talking about the women of the Walking Dead franchise.
Ooh. Wow, that was going to be an interesting discussion, because that's a very mixed bag when it comes to the women of that franchise.
Yes, so. It is. We've got good ones and we've got villains.
Yeah. Cool. I just want to say thank you again for being a great guest, Nita. We enjoyed you on our Star Trek review you were on, and you've been great again. So,
thank you so much. I had so much fun again.
Hopefully you'll come back sometime, because it's always good when you have a guest who's willing to contribute and do the work. So awesome. Just before I sign off then, DK, did you have anything else you wanted to shout out? Any upcoming projects?
That's everything everyone pretty much knows about, and if they don't, well, they should.
Yeah, if you haven't had a chance to check it out, we have got a review up that DK just dropped a little while ago for a movie called The War of the Gargantuas, which you may not have heard of, but please listen to the review anyway, because it's fascinating how popular this movie is for being so not very well known. And even though you might not be able to find the movie, it's a fascinating discussion, and I do recommend you going and checking that out if you're here, because you're familiar with this one and you maybe aren't familiar with that. So, yeah, that's it then. It just remains for me to say thanks again for everybody who's joined us and stayed with us till the end of this episode. Thank you to Nita for being a great guest, GK for being a great co-host.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And just remember, until next time, I'm back. I'm home all the time. It was... We finally really did it! You maniacs! You blew it up! Oh, damn you! God damn you all to hell!
've been listening to the Silver Scream podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Scream Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.